From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Democrat and Chronicle, which published a piece from a local executive coach and author. His name is John Kalia, and his piece was all about being an old white guy. I am not calling the man old. That's self-described, and his piece is about being, well, really an angry old white guy. Kalia writes that old white men are, quote, being increasingly blamed for all the ills of society, both real and imagined. Being a white male is now treated as an original sin, as though the constitutional form of republic asserting the equality of all and the rule of law were not also created by white males, end quote. And he's right to point out that more and more we hear calls for white men to get off the stage, or at least speak less and listen more. You can find thousands of tweets from people who write things like this. A woman named Melinda says, "Y'all don't make me vote for a damn old white man. I'll do it, but I won't be happy about it." A woman named Vaughn says, "Ask me again why I won't vote for a white man to be president ever again." Cindy writes, "I know a lot of people who won't vote for a white man anymore." The theme is that white men have had their day, and it's time for new ideas and new people in charge. Kalia writes that that's too broad a condemnation, and there are consequences to it. Frank Starpoli has different views. He's also an older white guy, and he's the author of a blog called A White Guy in Rochester. Starpoli is trying to explore what it means to carry advantage in this society, and he'll offer his thoughts about being a white man in 2019. So let's have that conversation. John Kalia, the guy who wrote that piece that brought us here today, an executive coach and author, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
And Frank Starpoli is the author of the blog A White Guy in Rochester. Frank, thanks for being back here. Nice to see you.
Thanks for inviting me, Evan.
John, I tried to sort of sum it up, but why don't you, I kind of see the stage to you, and why don't you tell us about what was on your mind and why you decided to write what you wrote?
Well, this is kind of a companion piece to something I wrote also in the Democrat and Chronicle about 2 months ago. The title of it was Stranger in a Blue Land, the subtext being the plight of a political moderate. And really, the overall context here really is that categorizing people leads to the kind of polarizing environment that we're all dealing with. And there's a larger, the larger context might be described as identity politics. So you start, what we do is we categorize people, and then we attribute bad behaviors to that category. And therefore, anyone who fits an ethnic, gender, or racial profile that fits into that category is generally speaking, guilty of all the sins of a few.
Okay. And do you feel like there is any justification for people like the women I quoted who are essentially saying, We've had 45 mm-hmm. presidents, 44 mm-hmm. have been older white men. We've got quite a few problems that we haven't solved in our society, and it is time. I want to see something different. Do you understand that? Do you feel like that's valid?
No, I don't. Frankly, if somebody says, "Well, I'll never vote for another white male again," you know, I think that's a mistake. Never's a long time. I remember when President Obama was sworn in, and there was a news piece that sort of toured the White House and introduced you to a variety of people, including his mother-in-law, who kind of moved in to help take care of her grandchildren. And she was asked if she ever thought she'd see the day where a black man was elected president. And she said, no, she never did. She never thought she would see it. If you think about that, I'd have to say, first of all, I didn't vote for Obama, but I was, in a way, proud of our nation. Because whatever our racial divisions might be, we as a country overcame those racial divisions and elected a member of a minority race to be president of the United States. So why doesn't that work both ways? Why is it that we can't judge people on their ideas or whether their ideas are or policy prescriptions are appropriate for the time? Why would that eliminate old white men?
Okay. Frank, do you find it persuasive?
I would agree with John. I think we're going to wind up agreeing on quite a bit. I would agree that it would be a mistake for somebody to say, "I'll never again vote for a white man for president." I also think it's a mistake for somebody to say, "I would never again vote for a black man for president." It's closing out openness to an approach. And so, yeah, I would agree with that piece for sure.
What about the broader premise here, that you think that John's concern is that there's too many generalizations, that it's time for white men to get off the stage, white men need to talk less, listen more?
That part, I believe personally, is what I'm trying to do myself, is talk less and listen more. And that comes out of my own convictions about the fact that white men are in the position of power for the most part in virtually every societal institution and so on. And if things are not going well, I think we need to be self-examining and self-critical. Because in my case, I would say, I am blind in some ways to how my privilege and my power as a white male has influenced people around me, or how it affects people around me, and so on. Being a male, too, for example, I have a wife and I have four daughters and I have seven granddaughters who are not hesitant to let me know when I'm doing something that it unconsciously is actually biased. And I think it's important for me at that point, rather than going to a defensive or explanatory posture, to just be quiet for a minute, listen to understand what their experience is, and see where there might be some truth in it.
Let me just probe a little bit here.
Yeah.
Because some listeners, and maybe listeners like John, would hear what you're saying and say, Frank sounds like a nice guy, but to me that sounds like virtue signaling. So let's get specific. When you say they're going to point out where you didn't realize an unconscious bias, what's an example?
Oh, let's see. There are many. I can think of it more probably in relation to race, where in the last several years I've intentionally put myself in situations where I am a minority. I've been going to meetings of organizations that are run by black leaders, trying to listen and understand what it is that they're saying. And when I participate, there have been a number of times where I will get quick feedback and blunt feedback about what it is that I've said. And at that point, again, I have a choice. I can either defend, try to protect my ego, or I can be quiet for a minute, check my emotional reactivity, and listen to what's being said.
Okay. John, do you find any of what Frank says there persuasive about privilege? Well, let's start there. Do you find white privilege is a thing?
I find the term offensive. And to be clear, I'll just mention an experience I had when I was briefly on the board, the editorial board of the Democratic Chronicle. When I was on the board, along with two other community members, that we were eight in number, five were women, three were people of color. And Karen Magnuson, who was the editor at the time, wrote a wonderful piece about diversity that described not only the goal and the progress of diversity in the newsroom and on the editorial board, but also the reasons why it was so important. And the reason it's was important, and still is that people of color and people of different genders have a perspective that needs to be considered. In the newsroom or in the editorial board, what that meant was we needed to understand the perspective of people that came from the black community in the city, people, particularly those who grew up in poverty, in order to have a rounded out perspective on our editorial views. So, I think if I were to say to you, now, just to be clear, the people I'm talking about, in my view, were intelligent, they were well-educated, they were highly qualified people. If I were to say to you that the people of color on that board were there to meet a quota, or they were there because of some diversity goal but didn't deserve to be there, I think a lot of people would find that offensive. I would find it offensive. And I view the comment about white privilege to be pretty much the same. You didn't get what you've got because you deserve it. You got what you get. You get what you got because you're a white man.
So, okay. So let me, and I'm sure Frank will want to weigh in on that, but let me just kind of extend that part of the discussion here. Do you acknowledge, do you see that in our society, there are certain situations, generally speaking, I am not talking about in any individual cases, mm-hmm. generally speaking, where people of color will have a harder time than a white person. Getting a job, getting a call back for a job, facing discipline in schools, facing discipline in the workplace. Do you think that generally speaking, people of color have faced different treatment than white people?
I would say yes, and I'll give you a personal example. And I've told this story many times. When I was born, I was the firstborn in my family, and because I was born, my parents were eligible for something called AFDC. Back in the day, that was Aid to Families with Dependent Children. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was welfare. My father worked his way out of that situation, became an entrepreneur, what we would now call an entrepreneur. We used to call him a businessman, we would call him, right? And was very successful. Retired in Florida. Before doing so, had a wonderful house and a wonderful community, et cetera, et cetera. This is in the 50s and 60s. There was no question in my mind that a black person could not have done what he did during that time frame, and not for lack of ability or education, but rather because of the prejudice of society. So yes, to the degree that you're saying that they would have been, that certainly in that era, treated differently,
yeah,
then yes.
But and there are a number of studies that simply indicate who gets a call back for a job could be based on how white or not white sounding their name is. So there are certainly some differences.
Right.
What I think I'm hearing, and again, I just want to have sort of an organic conversation, is that, John, if you see that there are differences, generally speaking, there's a danger to applying it every person you meet individually. That, oh, well, you're just a product of privilege, and you're dealing with oppression. Probably there is a discussion to be had separately, and a good discussion, maybe we'll have it here someday, about the fact that class probably gets held out of these discussions too often, that we're really divided in terms, for some reason, identity doesn't always take class into play. But it sounds like you're really concerned with how we judge individuals, immediately judging them based on certain these group ideas. But how do we square up the concern that in our society, generally speaking, there are still advantages to being white, even if individually we don't know what a person has gone through, if that makes sense?
It does make sense. I think I would go back to core principles, okay? Now, without getting into the politics of this, we are a nation that was based upon the equality of all people, right? The Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, but really what it means, first of all, it's not true. Not all men are created equal. But what it really means, the way we interpret it, is all people are entitled to equal opportunity. So I think the way to focus our energies, and I think people across the political spectrum can agree with this, is on ensuring equal opportunity. And that would be a way of sort of starting with a principle and then sort of, you know, if you sort of drop the pebble in the pond right at that point, the concentric circles would lead, I think, to better outcomes.
Frank, when he says he's offended by the idea of white privilege, are you offended by that?
No, I'm not. I do understand that people are offended by it, and I can understand it's a real trigger word. I think for myself, just to give a little bit of background on this, about 4 or 5 years ago, I started to really dive into the issue of race and racism because I saw that despite all of the civil rights legislation and all the goodwill and Obama being elected and so on, that there was still tremendous racial tension within the country, even over his election, actually. So I wanted to understand that. And I also wanted to understand, because I am into systems thinking, and I know John is an executive coach, as I was for about 25 years. Systems thinking says that if there is something dysfunctional going on in the society, and I'm a part of that society, I in some way have a role in what is happening. And I set out to find out, what's my role in this? Mm-hmm. How do I participate? In what ways might I be complicit? And that's when I began to uncover some of the what I would call privilege in my own life, and also my blindness to all of the ways in which other people, particularly people of color in this case, were not privileged. If some people are underprivileged, other people are overprivileged. So I began to dive into that. And in doing so, I was able to see in my own background tremendous privileges on the part of my family. You mentioned the previous era as if that's all over now, and I would say it's not. In doing the research, too, I found that, going along with what you're saying, Evan, every major system in our society is skewed to favor white people. And that's the financial system, that's the education system, it's the justice system, it's the healthcare system, housing system, et cetera. And that's coming out of not just a thought, but out of fact. And there are very few legitimate researchers who have disputed that. So to say that we don't have privilege, to me, would be like a denial of reality.
John, go ahead.
Well, I don't understand the word skewed in that context, to be honest. I'm not sure if you can identify how the system might be skewed. I think the responses of individuals within a variety of different systems might result in the kinds of things that Evan mentioned earlier, where a person who has a name that sounds black, whatever that means, mm-hmm. right, doesn't get the call mm-hmm. back for the job. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean by skewed?
That would be one example.
Okay.
One of many, yeah.
Right. So, but to me, again, it doesn't go to, I don't understand how that goes to the issue of privilege. What that really describes is sort of an inbred bias.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going back to principle, right, if you really believe that people should have equal opportunity, those of us who are self-aware enough to understand that we all inherently have biases should also then work to overcome those biases in practice,
as a practical matter. Would it be different if the word privilege was replaced with advantage, white advantage?
Hmm. I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that.
I ask that because what you're talking about is a desire for equal opportunity, not equal outcomes, not
right.
forcing equal outcomes,
right.
but equal opportunity. What Frank is saying is, we don't have that. We have advantage, and the advantage is based on race.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
I can't agree or disagree with that comment. I have to say that I'm aware of the bias. I'm aware the bias does affect people of color. Calling it an advantage for white people to me suggests that we've categorized ourselves in such a way that, you know, we put this group of people here and this group of people there. This group does better, this group doesn't do better, and there's only one reason for it, and that's race. And I don't think that's the only reason. I think that it's just life's too complicated to make that generalization.
Okay, Frank?
Yeah, I want to agree again with John about stereotyping. I think it's totally unfair right. to see any white person in that light mm-hmm. automatically, or to see any black person in a certain light or any right. other category of person mm-hmm. in any particular light. I couldn't agree more. At the same time, the facts are there in mm-hmm. the research very clearly stating that there are advantages. I'm thinking of the justice system, and I'll use myself as an example. The likelihood of me being stopped when I'm driving is incredibly low as compared to a black person. The likelihood of me then actually being asked to step out of the car is even lower. Mm-hmm. The likelihood that I would actually get arrested is even lower. The likelihood that I would be charged and eventually convicted and sent to prison is much lower than it would be for a black person. That's, to me, advantage or privilege.
So I'd have to say that, again, I feel as though you've generalized a little bit too much because it's more complicated than just race. What neighborhood are you in? How's what else is going on in the car? What else is going on in the neighborhood? What else is going on with police? There's a difference between, let's just say, Rochester and Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, we know what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, by virtue of Jeffrey Holder's findings, right?
Eric Holder?
Sorry.
The Attorney General.
Eric.
A.G. Holder, yep.
Yeah. Yep, I apologize. We were talking about failing memories before before the show. That's an example. Eric Holder's who I met, yes. Mm-hmm. And what he talked about there was systemic racism.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And but you know, there were a lot of people who still talk about Michael Brown as though he was guiltless. And I would sort of look at that situation and say, look, you have to separate the facts, as did Attorney General Holder, right? The facts of the Michael Brown case were separate and distinct from the facts surrounding the behavior of the police in that community, which more broadly was discriminatory, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think that Ferguson, Missouri is an example of what happens across the nation, although it certainly happens in a lot of places.
Okay, so let's do a couple things. I've got some phone calls I'd like to take, mm-hmm. And I'd like to welcome some feedback from listeners via email as well. We're talking to John Kalia and Frank Starpoli. John wrote a piece about being, quote, an old white guy in 2019, and we'll post it on various platforms if you want to take a look. Frank is the author of A White Guy in Rochester, a blog about his experience and his examination of his own life and how what it means to be a white man in modern times in this country, in some ways a reexamination of how he perceives privilege. Karen writes to us the following. First email's from Karen. She says, I'm a 69-year-old white female. Looking back on history, the killing, enslaving, raping, and pillaging, I think the case could be made that white males have been the scourge of the earth. If you're guessing that I must have had a terrible relationship with my father in order to say this, you're wrong. My dad was an honest and kind man who wanted his daughters, as well as his son, to have a college education. What a shame your guest is experiencing unease and discomfort because white male dominance and superiority are finally being called into question. Time to man up, pun intended. No tears, no pity here, from Karen.
Well, Karen, thank you for your comments. But here's the way I look at this. You know, it's not about white privilege. And really, you have to sort of look at her comments within a historical context. You know, the Americas were conquered by the white males of technically superior European societies. Now, you could call that raping and pillaging and
technologically superior. Yeah, right.
Technologically superior. Yes. Sorry, did I say technically?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Technologically superior, right? So they used that to their advantage. That was just an extension of something that's been going on since the dawn of time. That is the context within which the Americas were conquered, right? So if that's an example of raping and pillaging and why white males should be taken off the stage, I reject it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Frank.
If I could go back to the founding of our country, I know that you're crediting white males for all they did, and I would agree with you to a point. I think what they wrote was terrific. I think the concept of all, well, men it was at the time, mm-hmm. were created equal is wonderful. Mm-hmm. In the documents, it looks really good. But we know from the beginning that was compromised because the northern states were so determined to include the southern states in the Confederacy,
right.
that they sold out on slavery.
Right.
They allowed it. And they also said, because the southern states pushed for it, that they would count every enslaved African as 3/5 of a person in order to give southern states mm-hmm. better representation in the House of Representatives. So there was something really convoluted from the beginning, and that was old white guys. I also learned, for example, 10 of our first 12 presidents were owners of enslaved Africans. So, you know, to say that somehow, you know, white folks set it up really well and none of that continues today, I think is a real denial of reality and history.
Do you think none of it continues today? Or actually, it's sort of, well, let's do this.
Okay.
Let me frame it this way.
All right.
You strike me as a person who would not agree that none of it continues today, but the flaws of the founders are centuries old, that our society has progressed in different ways, and that a question that I have for you is sort of about either atonement mm-hmm. or redress of injustice. Mm-hmm. Is there a point where you feel like enough has been done mm-hmm. to level the field of opportunity, if not outcome, of opportunity? Has enough been done?
No. There's my straightforward answer. But I also want to go back to the history.
Yeah, okay. Here. Okay, sure.
Right. So let's go back not to the founding of the U.S. Let's go back several millennia. You know, from the dawn of time, wars between tribes, wars between city-states, wars between nation-states took place, and the result was the men, typically, of the defeated nation became slaves of those who won the war, right? And what happened to the women was not too pretty either along the way. That the United States of America, founded on core principles that were espoused by philosophers but were in practice nowhere at that time, but yet continued to allow slavery and be the last nation who allowed it, is an egregious disconnect. No question about it, right? But I think it's also very, you have to sort of look at the history. Actually, a book I would commend to everyone, including your listeners, is called The Battle for the Soul of America by John Meacham. It was a bestseller a couple of years ago. I just got around to reading it. And it really talks about the history of how we've treated immigrants and racial minorities from our founding. And really, what you pick up from it is how complicated human beings with serious failures were those who helped make the most progress. Mm-hmm. And really, he spends probably a quarter of the book, the last quarter of the book, talking about LBJ and Martin Luther King. But even leading up to that, you know, he talks about Lincoln sort of embracing the whole idea of being anti-slavery in order to get the northern states on his side. When he was seeking to, raise an army and fight the South in the Civil War, he talks about Teddy Roosevelt. On the one hand, being the first president to invite a black man to dinner at the White House, but on the other hand, being concerned about race suicide because birth rates among whites were so low. He talks about Harry Truman using racial slurs in private, but also being the guy who stood up to fellow Southern Democrats to assert that he was president of all the people and he was going to make sure that he did what was right for all the people. So there's
It's a mixed bag.
It's not just a mixed bag. I can still hear the voice of one of my colleagues on the editorial board when we were looking at political candidates to endorse. People are complicated. People say and do things that are inconsistent with their stated principles. It happens all the time. We're not error-free, right? So when I say we should be focusing on equal opportunity, I say it in the context of the question you've asked, which is that we're not there yet. I'm not sure if we'll ever get there, but unless we're all on the same page and striving to achieve it, we'll never get there. We'll never make progress.
So, Frank, you've got agreement with John there. We're not there yet. Your view on what we do about that is different than John's.
Yeah, I do. I think it is different. And I would say in my own beliefs that either you've got a racist way of thinking and going about life, or you're anti-racist, meaning that if we know the system is skewed, if there is disadvantage, if there is not equal opportunity, I need, this is my opinion, to be working toward correcting that. I need to be working to change it, rather than being somehow defensive about the fact that I'm being blamed for it. The blame in my mind is well deserved in a lot of ways at this point, because we are in charge. And also, I think just personally in my own life, I have to say, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who's a black man. We were talking about how he experiences life as a black person the other day. And he said to me, every morning when I get up, I look in the mirror and I think to myself, how is this black skin going to affect my life today? Now, when I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror. I may not like what I see, but I don't think, gee whiz, how's my whiteness going to affect me? Because I don't have to, because things are set up pretty smoothly for me. I don't have to worry about how I'm going to be perceived. If I speak out in a meeting, how will people hear me? If I say something in anger, will I look like the angry white black guy? So I see tremendous advantage throughout my life. And that's what I mean by privilege, and it's very real. And I think folks who have the opposite experience, mm-hmm. people of color, have taught me the extent to which I have that privilege by telling me that they don't have it, and many, many, many examples.
Mm-hmm. All right, so a few other points before we get our only break, and then we're going to spend the rest of the hour with phone calls and emails from listeners. You referenced Teddy Roosevelt and concern about birth rates. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a lot of discussion among some parts of our population, the white population, concerned about declining birth rates. Does that worry you?
No.
Not a concern?
No.
You're worried about becoming a minority in this country?
No.
Okay. Any thoughts on the kind of sentiment that, here's an email that I got this morning after we teased this program. Andrew says, here's one thing I don't understand. We hear about Black Pride. We hear about the Puerto Rican Fest. We celebrate diversity. But if I try to celebrate my whiteness, they tell me to shut up and stop being a racist. Why is that? I'm so glad John is making the case for all of us old white guys. John?
Well, when you first said Andrew, I thought it was another Andrew, but he's not an old white guy. He's a young white guy.
Oh, no, it's not that Andrew. No.
Right. Okay. Again, my call here is not for, I'm not trying to make a distinction along the lines of gender or racial division. What I'm really trying to say is something along these lines. I know women in my life, including my lovely bride, who don't feel welcome by the Republican Party. The response to that should not be to make white men feel unwelcome in the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really where I'm coming from here. It's polarizing behavior. So our tribal politics, our tribal social media discussions seem to be moving away from an ideal where we can work together in much the same way as old white guys like Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan worked together, and old white guys like Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich worked together, mm-hmm. in order to make progress, however we define progress at that time. Now we have a situation where no matter which party's in charge, we can't make progress just because the objective is really just to undermine the progress of the majority party.
If I could, John, I mean, I cannot and I would not try to speak for African Americans writ large, but a common concern is what you just described. Well, take Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. They worked together mm-hmm. for a crime bill that had disproportionate impacts on African Americans in this country. And now you have leaders, even white leaders in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, who are no longer sort of what some would call Republican light or conservative light or whatever the mm-hmm. case may be. And they're not willing to compromise because they saw that it was a bad thing for parts of our population.
Okay. So let's put this in context. Again, history is important here because you can't judge what happened in 1776 by the standards of today, and you can't even judge what happened in 1994 by the standards of today. And I think it's a mistake for politicians like Joe Biden to be apologizing for their vote. I remember 1994 when crime was rampant in this country and when the crime bill seemed to make sense to a large majority of the people. That doesn't mean that they were right. It doesn't mean that they had, but it also doesn't mean that they had bad intention.
But what's wrong with apologizing if you look back and you think you were wrong?
Well, it's different to, there's a way to apologize. Let's just be clear, okay? To say, look, this is the way we looked at it at the time, and I can see that there have been some unintended consequences, and we need to correct that, is different than saying, oh my God, I'm really sorry I voted for that bill, without qualification.
All right. Let's get our only break of the hour. Your phone calls and emails for John Kalia and Frank Starpoli next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Airbnb hosts in the Rochester Finger Lakes region brought in more than 50,000 guests by Labor Day this year. Almost 50,000 just in the summer alone. The rise of Airbnb under the microscope next hour. Do you use it when you travel? Is it convenient? Is it good for the economy? What about the impact on hotels and actual B&Bs? We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Don emails to say, I hope you'll touch on guilt. Should white people feel guilty, and if so, for what? Should white people feel guilty, Frank?
Should they feel guilty?
White men in particular.
I don't think it's a choice about how we feel. If I look back at history and I see what's happened, and if I look at the current situation and I see that white folks have tremendous advantage, I might feel guilt.
Do you feel guilt?
I do at times. I do. And at the same time, I'm not going to allow the guilt to decide what I do about it. Nor would I allow my anger about being accused of something determine what I'm going to do. The feelings come up. It's quite natural that I would be taking that on myself as, oh, my God, I'm part of what's wrong here. The guilt doesn't do any good, doesn't do anybody any good, me or the folks who are on the other end. So, yes, guilt comes up. It comes up in me. Anger comes up in me at times when I get the sense that I'm being categorized as the old white male and mm-hmm. being blamed for everything. It comes up. But what I've learned, and this partly, I want to say, John, goes back to a lot of the coaching that I did with executives. It's the ability to recognize that I've been tweaked and the ability to hold steady in the face of the tweak and try to understand what's actually happening mm-hmm. and what a healthy choice is in the situation, rather than staying with either the guilt, the anger, or anything else that might come up.
John, guilt?
Well, I'm guilty of whatever sins I may have committed, but I'm not guilty for the sins of all white men. I don't, again, you know, I really would like to say that I defy or decry categorization.
And I agree.
Right? I mean, what we're really talking about, it's kind of interesting, is when I was writing this piece, I happened to be in Wegmans and was looking at greeting cards, okay? And I read some greeting cards that were, you know, sarcastic and funny, and I said to myself, geez, what would happen if you reverse some of those, right? Now, I happen to be on the board of Resolve, which, as you know, is an organization that helps address helps support women, particularly, although men as well, who are victims of intimate partner violence, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, well, here's the first one. The first card said, not all men are annoying, and you open it up, and it said, some are dead. But if I were to reverse that and read it out loud at a board meeting of Resolve, I'm not sure that it would be well received, right? Mm-hmm. Not all women are annoying. Some are dead. So I looked at a couple of others, and here's another one that I've reversed. Okay, let's just see how this flies, right? Women have only two faults: everything they say and everything they do. Now the card said men, right. but if I say it right. that way, it, you know, it sounds offensive, right? Here's another one, right? If I said men must be twice as good at women as women to be thought half as good, fortunately, this is not difficult, that would be viewed as a sexist comment. Mm-hmm. But the card didn't say men, it said women. So these are not things that really offend me deeply. I mean, I don't go home and have sleepless nights tossing and turning because Hallmark or whoever printed those cards. But it's really part of the larger context. There are slang words that are now dropped into sentences that are routine now, like mansplaining, right? Mm-hmm. And it's ingrained in popular culture. I mean, the other extreme, of course, in the 1950s, when I was a little kid watching TV, we had Father Knows Best. Right now we have Everybody Loves Raymond and The Simpsons. It's kind of the opposite swing of the pendulum.
But you don't know any men who a woman makes a comment, the man basically doesn't listen, then the man makes the same comment thinking that they've just invented something new. You don't know any men who routinely do that?
I know people who routinely do that. I wouldn't say it's particularly a male trait.
See, this is where I disagree. And okay. I think that's mansplaining. But I think what I also hear you saying is even if that happens, we overgeneralize it and we sort of dismiss commentary from people by saying, well, you're a man, you're mansplaining. Is that fair?
I think that happens in some circles. I would say, though, within my circle of friends and family, you know, we can say almost anything to one another, and it's taken, you know, with a sense of humor, right? There are things that I would say to a female friend who I know well, jokingly, who would laugh, right? But I wouldn't say it to somebody I barely knew because they would be offended.
And on the subject of the cards,
okay,
we have a history in our society of allowing punching up and having a little bit less tolerance for punching mm-hmm. down.
Right.
And men have had a lot of power for a long time. Right. The notion right. of men, people making fun of men, mm-hmm. It doesn't bother me. And I understand, as you say, it doesn't bother you, but you think that this would be different if it were flipped. But the difference is, if it were flipped, it's the notion of punching down instead of punching up. No?
It could be. I mean, I guess what I'm really saying is that it's this criticism of men now has become ingrained. And we don't even think about it.
Could I let me just ask a question, John? I'm curious about this. With what you're describing, mm-hmm. with white men being blamed for so much mm-hmm. and so on, how does that actually cost you? What does that cost you?
Well, it cost me credibility to the extent that people along the line. Well, Evan started the show by quoting some tweets, right? Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. were basically saying, you know, get mm-hmm. off the stage. Right?
Okay.
So it cost me credibility, right? So I wonder how it is that we raise the prospects of people of color or women by tearing down white males. How do you raise people up by tearing somebody else down? How do we as a society function that way?
Right, and I don't agree with the tactic of tearing right. people down, for sure. I would agree with that. I guess what I'm getting at, again, is my reaction when that happens. Mm-hmm. And I am not going to allow somebody to shut me down when I believe I'm on target with something, mm-hmm. even if they're throwing the white male thing at me.
Right.
Right? At the same time, I'm trying to be really sensitive to that white male label because I could very well be coming out of that without even recognizing that that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. But Frank, do you also think that, let's say, I'm thinking of someone in Youngstown, Ohio, a longtime factory worker, a 55-year-old white man who's lost a job in a town where mm-hmm. there ain't no jobs,
mm-hmm.
being mm-hmm. told, well, buck up, you've got white privilege.
Mm.
Is there a cost to that, not recognizing mm-hmm. the impact of class and mm-hmm. and what has changed as well?
Is there a cost to that? For that person.
Is there a danger to just saying white privilege for all white people? As if that makes everything, quote unquote, easy.
Yeah, that would be a simplistic way of understanding white. Yeah, of understanding white privilege, and I would never, and to John's point, I think generalize to say that that person has had all kinds of privilege. I don't know exactly, but I also don't want to minimize what that person's been through, and just say, well, you know, you had white privilege all along. I guess you blew it. I'm not about to say that either.
Okay.
I don't know if that gets at your point.
What? To the phones we go.
Okay.
Next, in Rochester, this is Howard. Hi, Howard.
How you doing, Evan? How's it going, Frank? I'm glad I was able to get through. Hello, John. Evan, it's always good to have, for us to talk about racism. This is one of the most serious and potentially explosive socioeconomic, socio-political, social-cultural issues in our society. But it's potentially problematic when you have two old white guys talking about racism, and they are not experts. Clearly, they're not. I'm, in fact, kind of disappointed in terms of how some of the history is being butchered, especially by John. He's talking about throughout history, people have been conquered and people have been enslaved. Never in the history of the world has there been a system of chattel slavery before it existed in this society, and it's different than any form of slavery that ever existed. John and I might agree on one thing. We got to examine white women's role in racial oppression throughout the history of the world. But there's a lot to history. So, Evan, I hope that at some point you'll have two old black guys on to talk about racism, because that's what this really is about. It's not about just white male privilege. This is about racism. This is about us living in a white supremacist-based society. Let me throw a couple of questions at them quickly if I can. There's so much to talk about, but I do worry that this kind of conversation may cause more confusion than clarity. John talked about categorizing people. Well, people are black, they're white, they're old, they're middle class, they're young, they're, you know, and so forth. And that's not categorizing, that's describing reality. And those things do matter in a white supremacist-based society. But he moved quickly to the idea of identity politics. Wanted to talk a little bit more about that, because what I've experienced is when we want to call ourselves African, people say we're engaging in identity politics. No, we're describing who we are. And he also made a statement about overcoming division when Obama was elected. When did that happen? When did we overcome racial division in this nation? In fact, racism is worse in many ways, especially as it relates to segregation, than it's ever been. One more thing. Actually, I wrote down four or five questions, but just one more thing. Frank hit on something critical when he was talking about, he used the word skewed, and John claimed he didn't know what Frank was talking about, so Frank used the example of names, right? And John still seemed to not understand. John talked about something about inbred racist bias. There's no such thing. People are taught to be racist. It's not inbred. It's not natural. We're not born that way. We're taught to be racist. But just so that John is clear, because you said whatever a black name, whatever that means, if you hear Shaniqua, you don't think about white folks. If you hear Daquan, you don't think about white folks. If you hear Micheline, you don't think about white folks. So let's get real in terms of what we're talking about. I think that you do understand what Frank means when he says the system is skewed. He's saying it's racist. That's what he's saying. So I know that's a lot of them, but if they could address some of that, I'd appreciate it. And I hope you invite a couple of us old white, old black guys to have this discussion as well.
Indeed we will, Howard. And that's a fair request. And again, the point is not to say this is the one be-all, end-all conversation about race and division. This is to say there's a lot of talk in America today about white men getting off the stage, about people saying, I don't want to vote for an old white man. I want to see different voices. And we've got two white men with different views on the subject, in some ways sort of tangling over their differences and exploring where they might agree. So Howard made a number of points. John, challenging your history, and I'll let you respond to what you heard from Howard. Go ahead.
First of all, I think he makes a lot of good points. Right off the bat, I would never describe myself as an expert on racism. And I certainly have I frankly have rarely lived in a community that was heavily biracial. Howard, you're right. I'm not an expert. And in fact, I would just share with you that in my correspondence with Evan before I came on the show, I said, if this is a show about racism, I don't feel like I should be the guy that's on the show. On some other points, let me just sort of make some distinctions here. First of all, when I talk about categorizing, I'm not talking about racially categorizing. I'm really thinking more of political characterization. And this is the way it plays out. And it's kind of a lazy habit we all have as humans. Okay, so if I said if I had just met you and I said I'm really concerned about debt and deficit and the way the federal government mismanages our economy and so on, a lot of people would just automatically say, oh, conservative, and then they would tag me with a whole bunch of other things like he must be opposed to gay marriage, he must be opposed to reproductive choice, and so on and so forth. The headline might be true. I am a fiscal conservative. But those other things aren't true, right? If I first met you and I said, I have a gay son, and I was delighted when we got to a point where he could legally marry and enjoy the privileges of the same privileges as the rest of us. Again, categorization, the okay. habit we fall into, liberal. Well, he must stand for this, that, and the other thing. That's what I'm really talking about, is the degree to which we tend to categorize people and then attribute, particularly if we disagree, we attribute negative behavior to that category and therefore attribute negative behavior or even sort of an evil personality type, if you will, to the individuals who fall into that category before we even know them. So, I just want to make a point. I don't believe I used the word division when I was talking about Obama. I think I used the word proud. So even though I didn't vote for Obama, yes, I was proud of our nation for electing a black man as president. I would also have to say that I think Howard made a very good point about racism not being inbred. And if I use those words, perhaps I use them incorrectly.
I think the point I got from you is that throughout history, human beings are sort of tribal and have created war with one another with consequences.
Yes, I did say that. And I think where I was coming from is not so much that that racism is inbred as much as fear of the other is a natural instinct. And that we as a society have to think from a leadership perspective and you know, in terms of developing sort of a moral culture that overcomes those divisions, particularly in the United States. I mean, if you go to the Scandinavian countries, every one of them has a population smaller than New York, and every one of them is over 90% native-born. We don't have that situation here. For us to function as a society, we have to become more accepting of people who are not like ourselves.
And we are almost out of time. About 45 seconds. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I also agree with so much of what Howard said. Actually, Howard has taught me a great deal over the years, and what I know is that I don't know a lot. I'm learning continually how my racial attitudes, which have been bred into me over time in this society, show themselves, how they impact the way I think, the way I move, the way I act, what I do, what I don't do, etc. And so I've often said to people, I am no expert. And it's interesting, you said you had asked Evan to not focus as much on race because you're more into politics. I had said the opposite because I'm more concerned about race and engaged in it. I'll leave it at that.
Well, let me just say to Frank and John, and to Howard and to any critics, I mean, we can take the criticism and we're going to have many, many more conversations because this is an ongoing societal conversation. This is one small point of discussion among two guys who are older and white. I'm not calling them old. John Talia, Frank Starpoli, thank you both for being here.
Thank you. Okay, appreciate it.
Short break, more connections coming up.